back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, half past the hour here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. We're talking about Brian Little and his contract. He's a restricted free agent for the Winnipeg Jets.
Bush or Bush? Bush X.
It's Bush. It's the same thing. They just couldn't use the Bush name in Canada.
Little things. Good play on words by Remo.
Because it's a Brian Little thing.
Who advised us that tonight he's going to just chill and drink a bottle of wine?
No judgment.
No, I never said that.
That's what you said during the race.
You're making up stuff now.
Boys?
I heard it.
What?
Yes?
I definitely heard it.
Seems like it's pretty clear-cut what's happening.
I think you guys have a show to do right now.
You would think so.
We have little things to talk about.
Speaking of things that have a little chance of happening, what about an offer sheet for Brian Little?
Offer sheets, Drew, a couple of things people need to be aware of. First off, if you're going to offer an offer sheet.
Nice.
Well, but if you are going to do that, you need to have the actual draft picks.
They have to be your own draft picks.
You have to be your own draft picks. So it's not like you don't go around the league and every team is able to make an offer sheet, first off. The other factors, of course, is you need to have the cap room on your team. You need to be willing to really overpay. And let's be real. I mean, aside from, was it David Backes and kind of Vancouver, St. Louis going back at it, for the most part, or the anger between Kevin Lowe and Brian Burke, for the most part, offer sheets are for Sergei Fedorov, close to his prime, Thomas Vanek, Shea Weber. I mean, the cream of the crop. And Brian Little is a guy where if you overpay him, what you're doing, we'll talk about this with Blake Wheeler and even Bogosian, but if you overpay him, you're giving him a lot of cash, you're giving up draft picks for him, you're inflating your own salary structure, and the team has the ability to match. I just don't think it's a reasonable, or not reasonable, I don't think it's a realistic possibility here, in my opinion. What do you think, Ez?
I wouldn't expect it based on the comparables. I wouldn't expect it, no.
What do you give? The question is, if you think this is a realistic possibility, which I would assume most people do not think, what's the number? $5 million a year? Go ahead. First off, I don't think anybody gives them that much. If they do, the Jets are probably like, ooh, maybe we'll look at those draft picks. Maybe not. But five's kind of, I think, the number. Because the Jets, while they're not a full cap team, they certainly have owners who are able to incur those costs if need be.
It just seems like if somebody was to offer Brian Little a big contract, it just doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like it would be a realistic option. In terms of, you know, what are you seeing in his game? Or how desperate are you for a maybe second-line center that you think that he's going to be worth that amount of money and the compensation that you'd have to give up along with the actual cash?
Less than 1% chance. I don't think there's really much of a chance at all.
If you saw a Brian Little offer sheet come from any team, you would sit there and say, whoa, this is coming out of left field.
Yes.
What about a trade? What about a trade as a possibility there? Is there, you know,
I don't want to discount that possibility, Drew, but I think it'd have to be in conjunction with other moves this offseason.
Because if the Jets are trading their only centerman who's actually performed to a reasonable level
this past year,
Jokinen in his career, but Jokinen's about 130, what is Jokinen now, 36 years old?
Yeah, last year of his deal and all that stuff.
You know, so, you know, if you're talking about trading Brian Little, aren't you just decimating the one player who would actually fill a role in your center position?
But that's in a vacuum, right? Maybe you take a defenseman, you trade for a center, you take him, and you trade for maybe a left side defenseman, and you work the parts around. I mean, there are possibilities here that make this, there are situations that make a trade of Brian Little possible. Not probable, but possible.
So
I don't think we should discount it completely. I mean, Kevin Cheveldayoff has the opportunity this summer with draft picks, with free agents, with RFAs, with needing to fill some other roles with young players, to make some moves, to be creative. Doesn't mean he will be.
Doesn't necessarily mean that we think he should be.
No, but I mean, it doesn't hurt you to explore. I certainly wouldn't put him on a rote. I certainly wouldn't touchable.
If somebody sees something in him that maybe you don't see, you're willing to hear him out.
Or maybe somebody needs some offense and youth and offense and are willing to trade you to defenseman.
But it's to you as well, that would be unlikely, though.
Left side stay-at-home guy, and you could trade a guy like Byfuglien in theory for a top six guy who plays center. You don't know. Maybe you'll make that move. I mean, it's possible. I don't think it's probable, as I just said, but It's certainly a possibility. I would say it's probably below 10%, but I wouldn't say it's 0.1%.
You look at his... Sorry.
Well, I want to hear what Izzy got to say on that, because I think it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, it definitely is, and we haven't seen a major trade yet coming from Kevin Cheveldayoff, and you have to think that the most tradable guy right now is probably Alexander Burmistrov, but he might have intentions of going to the KHL.
Right. In his car.
But right now, Brian Little is a guy that has a somewhat questionable future because of the fact that he's playing first line and might not be a first liner going forward. So I definitely don't think if there would be offers, it should be off the table.
What about moving Little? You'd mentioned it. To the wing.
Well, I mean, I think Drew, his speed and his quick release could be conducive to a scoring role in that place, in a second line right wing spot.
Is he too undersized?
No, I mean, it depends on the line, right? You play on a line with Jokinen and Kane, who obviously have no chemistry, but Jokinen and Kane were both big guys, and you play on the right side. Doesn't mean, you know, that's fine. You can deal with that. I think that's a possibility down the line. He's played a little bit of wing. Depending on the situation, depending on their depth up the middle, if and when that occurs, then it's something to consider. I think so. Why not? I mean, roster flexibility is so important. People don't always realize that. I mean, playing Datsyuk and Zetterberg together, again, otherworldly players, but playing them together, playing them apart, having them play different positions. We've read in the Chicago Tribune today that Sharp, Kane, and Taves are going to be lining up on line one tonight for the Chicago Blackhawks. All three of those guys have in their careers played center. So having guys who can play different roles and play in different spots, you know, Boston, you think about Boston. Sagan's natural center, playing right wing. So you have guys who play different. Nathan Horton in his career has played center before. Having that roster flexibility is very important. So I wouldn't look away from having him play there. Right now it doesn't necessarily make sense, but maybe down the road it does.
How much emphasis do you put, how much value do you put on Brian Little's defensive responsibility?
Solid. Not Patrice Bergeron. He's a solid two-way player. He's not blowing me out of the water. But he's not making me think, why are you at the red line not backchecking?
Is he?
There's not much I can add to that. I mean, he's a responsible player. He's not the most physical. I don't think he ever has been. So I think I don't have a problem with his two-way game.
Okay, then give me the argument. Brian Little's agent. Mm-hmm. You're Brian Little's agent. You come into your first negotiating session with Kevin Cheveldayoff. Give me the argument that you're going to make as to why... What Brian Little is worth and why you need to get every last dollar for him.
Well, Drew, you're saying that Brian Little is coming to a point where he's peaking, where Brian Little's points per game this past year was 0.73, where he exceeded 50% on the faceoff circle, where he improved his assists to almost equal levels of the previous seasons in more games, that he's coming into his own, that he's developing as a number one line center, that he can be that guy, that he's proven to be that guy, that he drives Ladd and Wheeler. I'm not saying I believe these things, but that's what his agents are going to argue. That he is a guy who can play on the penalty kill, play on the power play, play at even strength, can do a lot of things. Now, we'll talk about Cheveldayoff's argument on the other side of that in a second. But these are all the things he's going to push. He's going to push that desperation. He may not say you're desperate for a center, but he may say, look at the situation you have right now. You need a guy like this. You want to make the playoffs, as it appears. Right? So there's all these factors. He can score, too. He can play wing if need be. He's flexible. He's reliable for the most part. I mean, you look at his games play total. I don't think that should be understated either. Since he's come into the league, over the past 5 years, 2008-09, he missed three games. 2009-10, he missed three games. 2010-11, he missed six games. 2011-12, he missed eight games. This season, he missed no games. So he's never missed over eight games. Yeah, he hasn't missed over eight games since 2008. He's reliable. He stays healthy. So these are all these things that his agent's going to push. And this is what we need. This is what we think he's worth. We'll go to arbitration. We'll go to UFA status. And that's going to be the huge thing as well.
Well, let's talk about the arbitration thing, the arbitration factor. Do you think? I mean, arbitration is an adversarial relationship.
It is, and it hardly happens anymore because I think the sides know the reasonable landing spot. But on arbitration, I mean, he's going to push arbitration, possibly. But people say, oh, you know, why not just push arbitration and then come out next year and hit the UFA market? That's a possibility. But there is an inherent risk in playing hockey. And that's why people sign long-term deals. Because Brian Little, small guy, gets nailed in the middle of the ice next year by Nicholas Cronwall, and he's getting concussion, he's not playing anymore. What's he worth in the open market? Bupkis. So that risk goes to both sides.
And I think for the most part, if you're looking at it from a what is Brian Little's agent going to say that will earn him that money, it's that he's done what's been asked of him. Mm-hmm. He's played on the top line. And even though he hasn't produced maybe in the same class as other centers in the NHL, he's been pretty good. And you look at the periods of this year where Brian Little hasn't produced, and there were parts of the season where he didn't produce at all. You look at that 5-game losing streak that the Jets had toward the end of the season, a lot of those games on the road, he was pretty invisible. But then again, at home, him and Andrew Ladd and Blake Wheeler produced quite well. So he has been an above-average player and one of the better offensive players, and he was absolutely responsible for a lot of the Jets' success this year. But then again, he isn't in the class where he can ask for, you know, the $5 or $6 million. So he can ask, based on these comparables, to, you know, similar production to an Alex Steen or a David Desharnais, who really got the contract based on one solid year and last year, because he came into the NHL late from the AHL, and Brian Little has been in the NHL since a young age. So he can argue that he has done what's been asked of him, played the roles, he's played power play, doesn't play a lot on the penalty kill, but he's always gone out there and given them a solid effort. And again, like Richie said, I don't think he's necessarily capable of ever breaking out into an 80 or 90 player. I mean, if he would have done that, he probably would have done that by now.
Right, and that's the thing. We'll talk about, I guess, on the other side of the break, what to argue for Kevin Cheveldayoff. But that's just it. I mean, as he's getting right to it.
Then let's go to the break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the argument from Kevin Cheveldayoff's perspective. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and of course the website is www.illegalcurve.com. We spent the last 45 minutes talking about Brian Little. We'll spend the next 15 coming to a conclusion as to what we think his next contract should look like. Prior to the break, we gave you the argument from Brian Little's agent's perspective. Now it's important to talk about the argument that Kevin Cheveldayoff, Winnipeg Jets general manager, would give in trying to come to an agreement with Brian Little. So what if you're Chevy, and you obviously acknowledge this guy has some pros to his game because you want to sign him, because if he didn't, you wouldn't be interested in signing him. You know, what are you going, what are you saying? This is, you know, we like him for X, but his drawbacks are Y. What are X and Y in this equation?
We like him. He can produce some goals and assists in the middle. He can log minutes, all the things we talked about. But he's never scored more than 51 points in a season. He's never tallied more than 30 assists in a season. Remember, this is a guy who's not injured. He's playing all the time. He scored 31 goals 1 year, 24 last season, two seasons ago, I guess now. Excuse me. But overall, we're looking at a guy who's never exceeded 51 points. Looking at a guy for two of the past three seasons hasn't exceeded 50% on the faceoff circle. A guy who, while he kills penalties, about a minute and a half a game, it's not a bad penalty kill. Not exactly a dominant power play player. A guy who you very well could argue has been riding the coattails a bit of Ladd and Wheeler. Could go the other way around too. Who really knows in terms of chemistry. But playing with talented players. Had a great opportunity. Hasn't taken the bull by the horns to be that number one guy. We like what he provides.
Let me interrupt you for a second. You mentioned Ladd and Wheeler.
Not big.
How much of that argument, how much of an argument can be made that Brian Little is really, that a lot of his success is a function of playing with Ladd and Wheeler, is he?
I think he does deserve some of the credit, but if you were to rate the three players on the line, you could easily make the argument that he's the third best player on that line. I would make the argument that he's the third best overall player on that line. There are limits to his game. Again, and we've talked about it a little bit today, and we've talked about it before, but he's not a physical player. And the thing with Brian Little, too, is he's a really good skater. He's a fast guy, and he's a really good stick handler. But he's never one of the most noticeable guys on the ice. And I think that, again, when you're talking about playing the first-line center, I think it's tough to pay him like that. And I think that's probably one of the arguments that Chevy will make, like Richie already pointed out. But he's, having said that, he's also a purely offensive player, responsible defensively. He's never out of position, and he's a pretty intense player as well. Brian Little isn't the best face-off guy, but he got better this year. His face-off percentage, as Richie pointed out in this article, got better this year than last year. But he's a smaller guy, and he has drawbacks. So again, you know, Brian Little isn't the type of guy that Jets fans are going to look at, or management is going to look at and say, oh, okay, you know, Brian Little, he didn't do what he was supposed to do this year. He does what he's supposed to do. But going forward, it's going to be tough to be a good, solid playoff team if he's the guy that you're relying on in that first-line center role. And it really is the most important position, in addition to goaltending. But you could argue that it's even more of an important position than goaltending, because goalies are really, as we know, very unpredictable. One year, the guy's good.
Yep.
I mean, look at Steve Mason, look at Brizgalov, anybody that you want to pick out, especially in the NHL. But he is the type of guy that... He's almost a little bit enigmatic in the role that he's been put in, because the cupboard was bare as far as centers go in this organization. That has nothing to do with Kevin Cheveldayoff. I mean, he's in a position where he's got, and Claude Noel's, they've got to use him as the first-line center. Look at this year. I mean, who are you going to put in? Are you going to put in Olli Jokinen as your first-line center? He wasn't doing much. So it'll be tough for him to not give him a 3 or 4 year deal, but he'll have to almost cut him down a little bit. I mean, we saw that with other players in arbitration. Now, I don't think he is going to go to arbitration, but he does have downfalls, if you want to call it that, which will prevent him maybe from getting a longer-term deal and getting paid more money.
It's also the opportunity that Cheveldayoff will pitch. You have the opportunity to be the first-line center here right now. We don't know how long that'll last. We can't make any guarantees, but the opportunity is there right now. And there's no guarantees that if he were to go elsewhere, he'd have that same opportunity. That's why it's kind of a mix. It's kind of a good fit for both of them. Could be the first line center here. The Jets can pay him based on really being a second line center in the National Hockey League, or lower end, real low end first line guy in terms of money. And both sides can walk away relatively happy. And I think that's that happy medium.
Well, let's talk about that. How many years would you give Brian Little? How many years do you think he? Never mind. How many would you give him? How many years do you think he ends up getting?
I think he ends up. I think they go back and forth in 3-5 years. I think they settle at 4.
Just split the difference.
Likely. You know, likely at 4 years. He's going to be 26 in November, you mentioned, Drew. He'll be 30 at the end of that deal, basically. And I think that's
gives him another chance to get another reasonable contract after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're 30, you can certainly expect to get, you know, if he performs at this level, you know, for the next 4 years or so, or maybe even a little bit better, you would expect by the time he's 30, he'd get another, you know, 3-year deal, and, you know, worth similar money, give or take a little bit. So it gives him an option for two sort of. If you give him 4 years, you're paying him pretty much like you would be paying an unrestricted free agent.
Yeah, one discount a year, but basically, yeah.
You know, he's getting the unrestricted free agent contract, so he would probably be eligible for two of those in the course of his career.
Two significant ones, yeah.
Two significant ones. Now, the money, you know, per year, you got to look at you got a new salary cap in the NHL. You got a $64 million budget per team. Mm-hmm. Per year, how much are you comfortable giving Brian Little? As I'll ask you.
I was thinking in between probably $3.5 and $4 million as a second-line center based on what other guys comparable to him are making. And I think that he deserves it. He definitely deserves it. It's not his fault that he's been told to be the number one-line center. And again, that label is difficult, but it's the reality going forward. They're going to have to get stronger. They're going to have to get more offense from the number one line center. But I do think, you know, somewhere around $3.5 to $4 million is where I would guess that he's going to end up.
And that's what I had him at. I had him at 3.75 for a 4-year deal for a total of 4 years, $15 million, Drew. And as you mentioned, in terms of those medians, 3.5 and 4. I think what happens is Cheveldayoff probably comes in at 3 years. You know, if you can keep it to 3 years, you're probably happy to do that. And I bet you Little's representative say one 5-year deal. Get this guy up to his 30, 31. And, you know, he's earned it. He's played 6 hard years for this organization, and we want 5 years. And I think they probably meet in the middle, 4 years. I think his agent asked for in excess of $4 million, for sure. I think Chevy wants to keep him about 3.5. 3.46 was the average of those four players. You could argue that those are players are all better or even or worse than Little, but I think you could have interesting arguments on all four of them, being Nielsen, Desharnais, Alex Steen, and Mike Fisher. So I think that's when you get the reasonable grounds in the middle. You know, 4, 3.5, 3.75 is a reasonable number. Four-year deal gives him the security of having a long-term deal. Longest contract he'll have ever signed, because the longest so far has been 3 years. You got 4 years. You got security of knowing where he's going to be, staying where he's going to be, having the opportunity of first-line center. The Jets get the ability to pay him at a number where he can play first-line. They can shift him to second-line. They can even shift him to second-line right wing, and his number won't inhibit, his cap number won't inhibit that ability and shouldn't cause too many problems. So you end up getting a reasonable number, a reasonable deal for both sides, and both sides staying relatively happy. I think that's what makes sense in this situation.
Do you expect this to be a contentious negotiation when it gets started?
We're going to break down Bogosian next week and Wheeler the week after, and I think out of the three, Little is the least contentious negotiation.
Is he?
I don't see this being contentious in the sense that I think that he likes playing in Winnipeg. He's been given all the opportunity. So, no, I don't.
And the truth is, if something's going on behind the scenes and, you know, he doesn't want to be in Winnipeg, or, you know, his family doesn't want to be in Winnipeg or whatever it may be, and these are just speculation, he'll say, you know, I'm going to take you to arbitration, or I'll agree to a one-year deal with you, and then, you know, I'm not planning on signing here afterwards. And that's something that he has that leverage for the first time in his career
And the Jets have the leverage still of Jokinen, Scheifele, Burmistrov, Slater, and all that stuff, and saying, okay, we'll get something for you and we'll trade you.
Yeah, we'll sign you, and we'll try and trade you. You know, we'll sign you, but, you know, you will be on the trade block right now. You know, if that's how the negotiation ends up occurring. I don't expect that to be the case. There's been no rumblings regarding Brian Little whatsoever. Yeah. It seems like he's just a hockey player playing hockey in a city right now, you know, for better or worse.
Canadian guy
from Edmonton. Yeah. So it's not like he's, you know, that Winnipeg is a small pond or anything along those lines. He knows what Winnipeg's all about. At that point, you know, it just seems like it should be a pretty straightforward negotiation. But it is worth noting that, you know, with these RFA negotiations, you know, there's no pressing timeline. He'll get his qualifying offer, and he'll probably get that. I guess he has to get that before free agency opens.
Yeah, I can pull up. I have that deadline. I can pull it up and give it to the listeners after the break.
Okay, so it's probably sometime, I would expect sometime, you know, end of June, beginning of July, between when the finals end and when the free agency starts.
Probably July. I'll check.
Yeah, okay, so we'll get you the day. He'll get his qualifying offer likely, and then they can start to begin to enter into negotiations to try and hammer out a deal. So long and the short of it, over this last hour, the general consensus in this room, Brian Little, 4 years, $15 million total cap hit, for an average annual value, a salary cap hit of $3.75 million. Let's go to break. When we come back, Mike Hyka of the Dallas Morning News is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. As we promised, regarding restricted free agents, qualifying offers have to be made by July 2nd this year, and a player has a right to accept a qualifying offer. He has to do so by July 5th.
If he rejects the qualifying offer, the team still retains his rights.
That's right. And most RFAs will reject the qualifying offer, and then they get to sit down and enter into negotiation or end up in salary arbitration, as the case may be.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Dallas Morning News, Mike Hyka. Mike, good afternoon. How are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing good. It's a little rainy down here, but not too bad.
It's a little rainy up here as well, so we have some things in common. I think it's probably a little bit warmer in Dallas, though, I hope.
Yeah, probably slightly.
Yeah. Mike, obviously the Stars have gone through a significant restructuring this offseason. You know, Joe Nieuwendyk was released as general manager. Jim Neal was hired as the GM. You know, was the hiring of a seasoned, experienced front office executive like Jim Neal sort of the natural progression in how Tom Gagliardi wants to run this franchise since he took over ownership?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've thought about a lot of all that. And you know, I think, honestly, what happened is the right guy came up at the right time. You know, had Mark Recchi been ready? Because he's told us on several occasions he's not ready to be a GM. But had he been ready, I could have just as easily seen, you know, Tom Gilardi going with that, because that's a man that he trusts. Jim White, who, you know, has a lot of ties with the Detroit organization, has known Jim Mill for years, and I think they just sensed that he was ready to take a GM job. He had looked at other places. He was wooed by Montreal last year, but basically they got the information, I'd say with about 2 weeks left in the season, that Mill was ready to take a GM job and that he would love to talk to Tom Gilardi and Jim Leitz. And it went from there. And, you know, I think it's funny. I think talking to a couple of the people here, it's always hard to lose your job, and it's always, you know, difficult when transition takes place. But one of the persons said, you know, when you look at this guy and you look at his resume, it's a little bit easier because you realize, you know, just what a gem the Stars are getting. So I think that all factored into it. You know, I don't know that there was an actual type or personality that Tom Gilardi was looking for, but there was, you know, he noticed a talent that was available. And, you know, I tell my friends, I compare this to Bruce Boudreau going out to Anaheim. I mean, they knew that was a good coach and that he wasn't going to stay on the market for a long time. If they wanted him, they needed to jump right then and there.
Mike, you know, in terms of hiring, you know, were there other candidates that Dallas explored? And I guess the second part to that question, maybe playing off of what you just said, what made Dallas so appealing to Jim Neal?
The first part, Tom Gilardi said he had a list. He's never shared that list with us. In my mind, had the process taken place without Jim Neal being a candidate, it would have taken a little bit of time. I think Tom Gilardi would have been, you know, he would have interviewed a lot of different people. He would have looked at a lot of different people. There are, you know, reports and rumors. I've never actually talked to him much about it, but he and Brian Burke supposedly get along very well. You know, both were up in Vancouver. Tom's from Vancouver. Brian worked there. So, you know, there was a thought process that Brian Burke might be in the mix. There was, you know, other guys that we've heard. But I don't know that there was a list. Like his quote, Tom's quote was, as soon as Jim Neal was made available, he threw the list away. So there wasn't even a process of, you know, sorting through much. It was just, are you interested? How much will it cost? What do you need? What do you want? How are we going to do this? And it got done very quickly. Why Jim Neal was interested, there's a lot of good here, and this is a credit to Joe Nieuwendyk and what he's had to sort through with the bankruptcy and everything. This team has been a mess for a couple of years, but in the process of being a mess, they've gotten some high draft picks. They've made some good picks. Les Jackson has stayed in here. When he was demoted from co-GM, he stayed in, and a lot of the stuff he started with the development program, you know, he continued to push, and so now they have a really good AHL affiliate in Austin area, in Cedar Park, the Texas Stars. They were one of the best teams in the Western Conference of the AHL, and, you know, all of the things that Jim Neal sees that are important to running a franchise, quote-unquote, the right way, are here. And he believes that with the prospects they have, with the development, with the AHL affiliate they have, and with 10 picks in the upcoming draft, that he can help set this team up for years to come.
Mike, you mentioned Joe Nieuwendyk earlier, and he was, of course, let go as the general manager before they hired Jim Neal. What was his biggest downfall, in your opinion, as a GM? What was the biggest factor that led to his dismissal?
Hard to name one. I mean, if you're going with, you know, what really probably affected him on the ice, and then, I mean, if you get to the playoffs two out of these 4 years, then my guess is you're not being dismissed. And I think that was the coaching choices he made. Mark Crawford was, you know, is certainly a very talented coach, but I'm not exactly sure that they got him at the right time in his career. And, you know, it just didn't work. The chemistry just didn't work with the veterans that they had. And then the second hiring, that would have been great as a first hiring. Like, if he would have hired Glenn Gullison 4 years ago and then let him, you know, work his way up, and then had he, you know, made moves to get away from Mike Modano and Marty Turco and Yuri Lehtinen, and had he done that 4 years ago, I think Glenn Gullison might have worked out. But again, bad timing. It just wasn't the right coach at the right time. So that in itself, you know, if you're just going to say what got him fired, that would be it. But and this is the hardest thing to say, just because he is such a nice guy. But I think he was just too much of a nice guy. He wanted things to be everybody to be friends. He wanted everyone to be happy. He wanted, you know, people to be treated like adults, and that, you know, you just you earn your respect and all of those things. He basically wanted it to be run the way a player would want an organization to be run, and I just don't think that's possible. I mean, after watching it for the last 4 years, I just it's like letting the students run the classroom. It's like letting your kids run your family. Somebody's got to be the bad guy. Somebody's got to sit up there and say, no, these are the rules. This is what you do. If you break the rules, here's the punishment. And the Stars just weren't very good at that under Joe.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. We're joined by Mike Hajka of the Dallas Morning News. Now, Mike, before I ask you this next question, in the interest of full disclosure, he is a friend of this show and has been on the program a number of times. That's former Dallas Stars assistant general manager Frank Provenzano. He was also relieved of his duties in the last week or 10 days or so. Was his release just a byproduct of being part of the quote-unquote old regime?
Probably. Yeah, I don't think he did anything wrong. I think it was a matter of Jim getting somebody that he was more comfortable with. And you know, that's just part of the process. It's interesting to look at how, you know, different things take place. Kirk Frazier is going to stick around as an assistant coach, and Paul Girard isn't. Well, Kirk Frazier was the head coach of the Grand Rapids Griffins for 4 years and was hired by Jim Nill to have that job. So it makes sense. Here's a guy that he's comfortable with and that he's got a history with, and Paul Girard is someone he doesn't have a history with. And I think it's that simple. I mean, if you were taking a job, you would probably want to put your people in place. And so that's what I think is good, you know, is the situation with Frank. He's done a wonderful job, and, you know, I think he'll pop up in the NHL someplace else. So, yeah, I think he'll be fine.
Really has been a lot of changes in Dallas. Of course, we haven't even mentioned Glenn Gulletson. Mike, he was hired June 17th, 2011. Of course, we're in May of 2013, so less than 2 years on the job. He's been relieved of his duties. Considering kind of the flawed roster he dealt with the past two seasons and having both of those teams at least competitive in terms of a playoff chase, what do you think about that decision? And I guess, we're getting back to Jim Nill having his own players and his own people in place, but you know, maybe Gulletson, can you speak to the job he did over the course of those two seasons and maybe what you expect for him in the future?
Yeah, I think it was a growing experience, and Glenn will tell you that. Last year, he part of the situation, again, we'll go back to, you know, Joe setting up in a bad way. Part of the situation was the first year he was a head coach. Paul Girard was his assistant. He was familiar with Paul, but neither of them had ever coached in an NHL game, and Willie Desjardins was the associate coach, and he had only, you know, had 1 year of experience. So that was a really inexperienced bench, and they clearly made rookie mistakes. And, you know, even things like, and it, you can't always say that you're right or wrong, but, you know, 99% of the fans would have called a timeout at this certain time. 99% of the fans would have put these lines together. 99% of the fans would have made an adjustment on the power play, and he didn't. And I think, you know, that just started a lot of criticism of, you know, does this guy know what he's doing? And I think it was just a process of, you know, he did know what he was doing. I think he was a little bit nervous, and he just didn't have the experience. And after they made, and then the second year, of course, one, you had the lockout. Two, you add Jaromir Jagr and Ray Whitney, who, you know, are as old as Glenn Gulletson. And, you know, it's hard to coach those guys. They're icons. But, you know, here's a second-year NHL coach who's 41 years old trying to coach a 41-year-old, you know, future Hall of Famer. And that was just a tough job. And then once they made the trades to get rid of Jagr and Derek Lory and others, and they brought in some younger guys right. Who were, you know, willing to listen to the coach and do exactly what the coach told them to do. They were a much better team. So it's funny, at the end of the year, you know, as they're sizing everything up, there was a lot of debate on whether they just should stay with Joe Neuendijk, stay with Glenn Gulletson. They had learned a lot in the, you know, last 20 games of the season, so why don't we just go forward with them? But again, that's not what the owner wanted. That's not what the new GM wanted. So you just get on the roller coaster and ride along.
Mike, the Dallas Stars have the head coach and coaching vacancy right now. What kind of coach do you think new general manager Jim Nill will be looking for? We've heard a lot of rumors. Alain Vigneault, maybe Dave Tippett, if he doesn't choose to stay with the Coyotes, even though that looks a little bit more likely now that Don Maloney's re-signed. Do you think he might even look for someone that had ties to the Detroit organization?
It's interesting because I think, you know, I've talked to him several times about this, and and I tend to probably color it with my own opinion of what they need, and I think fans do the same thing, and maybe even some of our columnists do the same thing. I think Jim Nill's wide open. I think he is looking for the right fit, and it's such a nebulous word, and it's so difficult to nail down, but he goes with feeling and gut. And, you know, he said when he you know, decided to take this job, it was the right fit, the right team at the right time, and then he just felt it. And that's what he's going to go with on the head coach as well. On the fortunate side, I think they have time. You know, Vancouver's open. Colorado's still their job. There could be other openings, but this is, you know, there should be, you know, five or six great candidates for possibly two jobs. So in that regard, I think he has the time to take, you know, that. Yeah, if he gets beat out on, you know, on somebody to Vancouver, well, he'll just have to deal with that. But everything I can tell is he's going to talk to a lot of people and a lot of different people. People who have been AHL head coaches but not NHL coaches. People who have been NHL assistant coaches but not NHL coaches. People who are NHL coaches and are ready to step right in. And he's just going to try and get that feel for, you know, what he wants and what in his gut is the right chemistry. So it's going to be a very interesting process. The thing that I'm tinging it with is my own belief that they need a veteran coach. So, yeah, I would say Vigneault, Tippett, and Lindy Ruff. Those are your three top candidates. I think all three would do a wonderful job, and then it's just up to the GM to decide, you know, which one is the best fit, and if Dave Tippett's available.
Mike, we'll let you go on this last question. It's sort of a two-parter. You mentioned on your blog on the Dallas Morning News website that the Stars are hoping to emerge as the team of the Southwest in the United States. Can you sort of give us any insight into how they're hoping to achieve that? And then secondary, it seems like the Dallas Stars are about to unveil a new logo that has been leaked, whether intentional or not is up for discussion, that has also been leaked and is available on your website. You know, how has the new logo been received by the Dallas Stars community?
Well, I have a great respect for Jim White. Simply for the fact that I really believe in his heart he loves this organization. Like, he's worked with the Texas Rangers, he's worked with the New York Giants with the new stadium and everything like that. He calls me every now and then just saying, hey, what's going on, even when he wasn't working here, because he loves the Dallas Stars. So when Tom Gilardi came in and named Jim White the CEO president, I think it was a great move. And the day that started, you know, Jim White looked at the arena and saw 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people, saw the television ratings, saw, you know, the uniforms, which a lot of people thought were just horrible, and said, we're changing all this, and we're going to change it quickly. And so, you know, boom, he started to go into action on the new uniforms. Tom Gilardi's had a big hand in it. White and a lot of the front office people have had a big hand in it. All indications are it's going to be green with white, black, and silver, and that the gold will be gone. That this new logo will be there. It's a new branding. And, you know, they want a new look. They want to be a new era Dallas Stars team. And so to go with that, there's a Fox Sports Southwest. It's a carrier down here. And they were very strong in Houston while Comcast went in and grabbed a couple of the teams in Houston. So Fox Sports Southwest still shows Stars here, or now shows Stars games in Houston instead of Rockets games. So now Jim is saying, okay, well, that's an audience we can tap. And here's San Antonio, and Fox Sports Southwest can show Stars games in San Antonio. And here's Oklahoma City, and Fox Sports Southwest can show Stars games up there. And so what he is trying to do, you know, by calling himself the team of the Southwest, is they're going to hold training camp in Fort Worth. They're going to have a preseason exhibition game in Oklahoma City. They're going to have a preseason exhibition game in San Antonio. My guess is they'll have some sort of game. I would guess at some point they might even discuss a regular season game in Houston. And they're going to just try and expand the footprint of hockey in, you know, you want to say Texas, but it's bigger than that. I mean, like I said, Fox Sports Southwest goes up to Oklahoma City, goes all the way east to New Orleans. And I think there's this thought process that, hey, let's dream big. Let's make this big. You know, he was here when they, you know, took that team from 93, which was not a very good team, all the way to 99, which was the Stanley Cup champions. And I believe he has that vision that we're going to do this. We're going to do it big. People are going to be excited. It's going to be a huge financial success. And that's kind of what he's embracing right now, and we're just seeing the first steps of it all. He has big plans, and he's trying to put them in place.
Mike Hyka from the Dallas Morning News, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Great insight into the Dallas Stars organization, as always.
Thanks a lot, guys. It's always good to be talking hockey in late May.
Wouldn't have it any other way. You know that, Mike.
I know.
Thanks very much, bud. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Past the top of the hour, a big thank you to Mike Hike of the Dallas Morning News for having just joined us to talk about the Dallas Stars. In case you missed any of that interview, we will have it available both on LegalCurve.com and TSN1290.ca. While you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, head coaching change, an inevitable head coaching change, in my opinion, after the way they were eliminated in the playoffs this year, occurred in Vancouver earlier this week when Alain Vigneault was released as head coach of the Vancouver Canucks. Was he paying for the failures of Mike Gillis?
In part, maybe in large part. Mike Gillis, you look at the... I did an article I put a year or two ago about who constructed, maybe it was last year actually, who put together, maybe Remus can Google it, who put together the Canucks' current roster. Now it's obviously changed a little bit since I wrote the article, but the idea was how much of it was Brian Burke, how much of it was Dave Nonis, and how much of it was Mike Gillis, and who were really the most successful players brought in, and brought in by who. And Gillis didn't look so good in that piece, and it's obviously, you know, a shorter window because he hasn't been there for as long as maybe the other guys were, in Brooke's case, I believe, but... You know, his moves, some of them I liked at the time, haven't worked out. And that has to fall on his shoulders. But at the same time, part of that responsibility falls on Alain Vigneault as well. And he can't be given a free pass by any means. And I think one of the reasons for that is the way they've gone out the past two seasons. You go out in five games. I realize you had the Sedin injury last year. You go out in five games, granted to the eventual Stanley Cup champions. But you go out in four games to the San Jose Sharks this year. And your teams in both cases were considered the favorite by Vegas. So you didn't lose in seven to the underdog. You didn't lose in six to the underdog. You lost in five or four. And you went out, you know, it was a weak performance in both cases. And you seemed to have difficulty adjusting. And your team, you know, didn't seem overly motivated, didn't seem desperate at the right time. I think a large part of that also has to fall on Alain Vigneault. I think the two of them kind of bear equal responsibility, really.
Yeah, and which first round defeat felt worse, right?
Right.
I mean, was it last year's five game defeat to the LA Kings? Was it this year's four game sweep to the San Jose Sharks? Both really are pretty bad when you're a team that's coming off a Stanley Cup Finals appearance. And Alain Vigneault had the Sedin twins for the entire time he was head coach. He had Ryan Kessler, and I think he is a good hockey coach.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about the way they went out, the fashion that they went out, the lack of a fight in the last two playoffs, you know, we talked about this a little bit before. The Vancouver Canucks have almost become a bit of a regular season team, a team that can't get it done in the playoffs, notwithstanding the Stanley Cup final appearance against the Boston Bruins.
They couldn't score there.
And someone had to take the fall for this one. Someone had to, mm-hmm. because no one took the fall last year.
Right? Is there anybody, are the Canucks too easy on themselves? Are they always looking for a conspiracy theory as to why they lose, as opposed to having any real accountability for their on-ice failures?
Part of that, but I think kind of like Vigneault's strength is his calm demeanor for the most part and his ability to be easygoing, at least the media, and overall he doesn't really demonstrate too much of an emotion behind the bench. I also feel like from afar, we don't live there and see it on a day-to-day basis, but I also feel like he almost is too calm, and he doesn't necessarily show that desperation, and I think his team kind of plays off of that a little bit.
I think that's a good point. I think you are your coach. I mean, that, you know, Mike Babcock really brings that blue-collar effort to the Detroit Red Wings, and I think all those guys buy into it. I think they work harder than a lot of teams. Look at the New York Islanders. I really do think the coach, Daryl Sutter, is another guy that instills that type of work ethic in his players.
Yeah.
And I think that when you're talking about the Vancouver Canucks, I think they've almost had it too easy. They're blessed with two really good goalies. They have so much skill. They've got up-and-coming defensemen in addition to veteran defensemen. And I do think that their approach is, whatever you want to call it, lackadaisical, or they're not a hard team to play against in the playoffs. The LA Kings are a hard team to play against. The San Jose Sharks are a hard team to play against. But if you look at skill-wise, I mean, how else do you, and again, I don't want to, you know, just pick on the Sedins right now, but the last couple of years, I mean, the Sedins have not been effective players in the playoffs. And it's not just point totals, because they had some points in those four games. It's just the way they're leading their team, the way they're playing defensively, the way they finish checks, stuff like that. I mean, you compare the Sedins to Zetterberg and Datsyuk.
Yeah, different team.
It's not even close. I mean, they're good offensive players. But two-way players, sure, they've gotten better as their careers have gone on, but they're not a playoff. They're not a team that's really built for the playoffs, if you think about it.
Yeah, and that's Gillis' responsibility for that. And you look at Vigneault again. I think he's a good coach. I really do, and I think he'll land on his feet very quickly. But one thing, you know, his record over the 7 years is incredible. It's a very, very good record. But I also want to point out one thing, because we need to point out all the facts, I think, in this situation. Was there any team in that division over those 7 years that was any good?
No, he got the beat up on the weak sisters of the Western Conference.
Was Minnesota, Edmonton, or Colorado any good during those 7 years?
No, he got to play, you know, six games a year against teams that were not only inferior to Vancouver, but they were probably inferior to most of the Western Conference as a whole.
I mean, when was the last time Minnesota made it this year? But Colorado had those kind of those fluke years. They made the eighth spot or seventh spot. But I think over the course of the past 7 years, those teams collectively made the playoffs four or five times.
I would think so. It's
about equal to how many times less than Vancouver made it. Anyhow, doesn't mean he doesn't deserve credit because he played against other teams in the league, of course, and were very successful, and they had great numbers. Vigneault was forward-thinking, and his ability to work with Gillis, who people thought he'd get rid of immediately. I thought when they hired Gillis, he'd get rid of Vigneault immediately. Gillis gave him a fair shot, or at least a pretty good shot, and Vigneault, I thought, did a really nice job. He used the guys in certain situations, you know, known for face-off, Malhotra for specializing in face-offs, and Sedin's in the offensive zone, and all those things. I think what happens with coaches sometimes is a message, for whatever reason, doesn't get through. And it's that classic cliche. It's easier to get rid of one coach than 20 players. But the downfall of the organization the past 2 years and the kind of flux they're in right now and where's their window, kind of a similar conversation to San Jose, that responsibility in the big picture is more Mike Gillis. These losses, I think, are Mike Gillis, but they're also Vigneault. But the big picture is a Mike Gillis issue. And how can he fix that? They drafted poorly.
Mm-hmm.
They've mismanaged the Luongo situation.
Mm-hmm.
And their trades haven't worked out. For the most part, almost all of them haven't worked out.
Mm-hmm. Even if we like them. I mean, even if the general observer says, you know, these are trades that make some sense. For whatever reason, they have not worked out.
I mean, Nonis acquires Luongo. Gillis gives him the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who brought in the Sedins in the article?
Brian Burke. Mm-hmm.
The Kessler and Schneider, those guys were drafted, I believe, on Nonis's watch.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the core of this team, the best players, I mean, he's brought in guys like Hamhuis. Garrison wasn't great this year. Hamhuis is a really solid defenseman. But
they developed Edler. I guess he gets the credit for that.
He didn't draft
him. He didn't draft him, but I mean, you know.
Developed him.
Yeah.
But Nonis played a good role in that. Obviously, the Moose played a big role in that, too.
Mm-hmm.
He signed him to a reasonable contract, but what did Edler turn out to be? You know, BX was there before he got there.
Sure.
Ballard trade didn't work out. So, there's holes. Can't draft. And they haven't drafted well.
Mm-hmm.
Can't fill those needs, Ezzy. And, you know, the trade guy, David Booth, a guy player I like, didn't work out. Let's call a spade here.
Yeah. Who's the right coach for there? Who's the right coach for that situation now? Is it a veteran?
Well, there's two. Well, I'm thinking. It's that Dallas Eakins kind of new blood thinking. Part of me thinks if Mike Gillis is so cutting edge and forward thinking, he'll want to hire a guy like Guy Boucher, who's an offensive coach who likes speed, who's got a goaltender who he didn't have in Tampa Bay and can play that style. Now, Stamkos and St. Louis are better than the Sedins, but that idea, I can see him considering that. But I really am not sure. It's going to be a real telltale sign in terms of the direction, style of play-wise and personality-wise of how this team's going to be going in the next 3, 4, 5 years.
Right, and they made the easy decision. Now it's how do you go forward, because you don't have the best prospects in the league. Right. Are you going to move someone? Are you going to try to go with the same old? We know who they're moving for sure. Luongo's getting moved. at least one of those two guys is getting moved. They're not going to go through that dog and pony show again. But well, I don't. I really think, Drew, that Alain Vigneault's tenure is really going to be summed up by really good regular season team, a team that did get to the finals one year.
Should have won
really
that year.
Be, maybe mm-hmm. you could argue that they probably should have won that year, or they were very close. They were obviously were very close. But the last 2 years, they flopped in a high seed in the first round,
right.
four games and five games. And to me, what's really interesting is what happened that they were so bad in the playoffs and were disposed of so easily. And I think that's what you're going to look at. That you know, we talked to Mike Hyka about what was Glenn Gullitson's downfall, pardon me, Joe Neuwendijk's downfall as a GM. As far as Vigneault's downfall as a coach, it was not having them ready in the first round of the playoffs the last 2 years.
That's right.
Agreed. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to head out to Saskatoon, talk to Sundaya Sapurji from Yahoo Canada about the Memorial Cup tomorrow. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website with the latest NHL and Winnipeg Jets news is www.IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
Let's welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. She's the junior hockey columnist for Yahoo Canada, Sundaya Sapurji. Sundaya, good afternoon. And how is Saskatoon on this fine Saturday afternoon?
It's very gray and cold today.
It sounds a lot like Winnipeg today, then. Good hockey weather, though, right?
Excellent hockey weather.
Tomorrow evening, it's Halifax, the Mooseheads against the Portland Winterhawks for the Memorial Cup. Given both teams' bodies of work throughout this season, is this the matchup of the two best teams in Canadian junior hockey?
Definitely. I think they've been the two best teams all year. If you look at their play in the regular season, if you look at their play in the playoffs, you know, there is a reason that these two teams were ranked 1 and 2, respectively, in the Canadian Hockey League at the end of the regular season. And they definitely showed at the tournament that they're two of the best teams here.
Sunaya, when the Portland Winterhawks met with the Halifax Mooseheads earlier in this tournament, they handled them pretty well. That was the Halifax Mooseheads. I believe it was 6-2. Is that correct?
I think it was 7-3.
7-3. Okay, I was close. I was only off by a couple there. But in your opinion, watching the Portland Winterhawks throughout the Memorial Cup, what adjustments do you think they're going to have to make in order to handle the Halifax Mooseheads in tomorrow's final?
Well, I think they're definitely going to have to do a better job of containing Nathan MacKinnon. You know, they didn't do a very good job in that first game. And then by the time they'd made adjustments to, you know, handle MacKinnon, it was their secondary scoring, you know, guys like Brent Andrews and Darcy Ashley who are putting the puck in the net. So they're really going to have to shore up their defense. Seth Jones didn't have a very good game in that matchup. So talking to him last night, he said he's looking for some redemption here.
You know, so now in terms of all the spotlight, it's going to be on Jonathan Drouin, Nathan MacKinnon, Seth Jones tomorrow, those guys being the top three draft picks likely in the draft when the draft takes place on June 30th in Newark. Who are some of the other players in this game who people may not be aware of who've had a big role in bringing these teams to this point?
Are you talking about guys who are eligible for the draft? Or
yeah, ideally, just to give to give our listeners kind of an idea of who will be around and possibly keep an eye on.
Well, for if you're talking about the Halifax Mooseheads, some guys to keep an eye on, it would probably be Martin Furk, who plays on the same line with Drouin and MacKinnon. He's a Detroit Red Wings prospect. Of course, Zach Fucali, who is eligible for this year's draft as well. He's the top-ranked goaltender for the draft. You know, he had a really good game the first time they played against Portland, so he's another guy to keep an eye on. On Portland, you'd have to watch out for Ty Roddy. He's the top scorer in the Western Hockey League. He's leading the tournament in goals, so he's very dangerous. Matt Carruth, who had a shaky start in net for Portland, he's coming on strong. So, yeah, I would say those are the guys to keep an eye out for tomorrow.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Sunaya Sapurji, junior hockey columnist for Yahoo Canada, previewing tomorrow's Memorial Cup.
Sunaya, we're really familiar with Brendan Leipzig here in Winnipeg. He's from Winnipeg. We've actually had him on the show before. We had him on as a 16-year-old when he was in the World Under-17 Challenge. How important have he and Ty Ratty been? And I guess you've already mentioned he's leading the tournament in goals, but how important have those two guys been all year, and how important are those guys going to be when they're matching up with the likes of MacKinnon and Drouin for Halifax?
Oh, they're going to be huge. And don't think you can talk about those two without also mentioning Nick Batan. You know, that top line has been so deadly against the opposition for Portland the entire year. So I think that maybe one of Halifax's biggest jobs Sunday is to make sure that they keep them in check. Because if you saw the game last night against London, you know, they really did a number on the night.
So now when you know, people who are watching the Mem Cup who maybe don't always watch junior hockey, maybe focused on Seth Jones, as we mentioned before, MacKinnon and Drouin. Now, MacKinnon and Drouin are interesting. Now, MacKinnon obviously has been the player who's garnered the most spotlight kind of throughout his junior career, and Drouin's really emerged as the top guy as well. If you were an NHL team and you had to pick between the two, being MacKinnon and Drouin, who would you pick?
I think I would actually go with Nathan MacKinnon. You know, Jonathan Drouin has really stepped into the spotlight ever since his play at the World Juniors, I would say, and he had a fabulous tournament. But I think overall, in terms of progress and feeling, I would go with MacKinnon.
Sudai, have you seen anything throughout the course of this tournament that would make you think that Seth Jones isn't going to go first overall? Because as we know, Popeye Jones was introduced to hockey by Joe Sakic. There's ties to Colorado there who have the first overall pick. Is there anything that you've seen the way he's played that he won't go first overall in the draft in June?
No, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people after that first game, you know, where Halifax won and, you know, MacKinnon, there was that great goal MacKinnon scored where he stepped around Jones there. A lot of people were like, oh, you know, obviously, you know, maybe MacKinnon should go number one. But you have to remember that these scouts have seen these guys, you know, in many cases, or at least in their case, since they were probably 14, 15 years old. So it's not just one game that's going to make a difference. It's kind of over the course of their careers, how they have adapted to certain situations and that kind of thing that's going to make the biggest difference. So, yeah, one game or one tournament isn't really going to make or break. I think what's more interesting is the fact that Patrick Waugh is now going to have some input into the draft, and he is very familiar with Nathan MacKinnon and Jonathan Drouin, having, you know, coached against them in the queue. So I wonder if that might actually be more of a factor.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Sunaya Sapurji. She's the junior hockey columnist for Yahoo Canada. We're talking about the Memorial Cup. Sunaya, in terms of draft-eligible players, you know, the draft upcoming in New Jersey at the end of June, is there one player in particular who has boosted or has hurt their draft stock as a result of their play in the Memorial Cup? And you can also include the Saskatoon guys or the London players as well.
You know, I think Bo Horvat had a really good tournament for the London Knights, as did his two teammates, Max Domi and Nikita Zadorov. So I would say that if I had to, you know, pick a few guys who I think kind of showed the scouts something extra, it would be those three. Otherwise, I think pretty much it's been par for the course. I think everyone's kind of played the way we expected them to play. Like, I've seen MacKinnon and Drouin quite a bit this year, and so I'm kind of used to seeing them, you know, make the pretty passes and, you know, scoring big goals. So that was pretty much what we expected to see from them.
So now a final question. What's the experience been like in Saskatoon for you with the Blades kind of being the team that everybody expected would not have a crack at the finals?
You know what, I think it was really hard for them. You know, they had such a long layoff, and I know Lauren Malkin probably tried his best to get them in game shape, but, you know, if you're off for 51 days, that's going to be pretty hard, and I think they definitely showed some rust in the opener. But for them to beat Halifax, which, you know, they're the number one team in the country, that was pretty huge. But I also wonder if Halifax kind of took them lightly because of the fact that, you know, they were swept in the first round. I think it was very disappointing. I think talking just to people around Saskatoon, they're quite disappointed with the performance here.
So, Niall, we'll let you go on this last question. Obviously, we have to ask it. Tomorrow, who do you have, Portland or Halifax?
Oh, geez, put me on the spot.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm kind of leaning towards Portland, only because I don't think they will have the same kind of play that they showed in the first meeting. But like, my heart says Portland, but my head says Halifax. How's that for a cop out?
Sounds like that's a very political answer. Well done. Sanaya Sapurji from Yahoo Canada, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thanks, guys.
Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. As we do every Saturday afternoon, finish the program with a little Bruce Springsteen. Who is this? What song is this, Richie?
Atlantic City.
Okay. Just asking. Not all of us, not all of our audience may have the expertise that you have in Bruce Springsteen. So if you can educate while rocking out at the same time, I think it's considered a win-win situation.
Yeah, I'll agree with that, Drew.
Okay, there you go. There you have it. Alex Burmistrov supposedly wants out of Winnipeg.
What about his car?
Yeah, Remus, you conducted a segment on his car with Rick.
He's actually talking about sports cars in general and, you know, the allure that they have for professional athletes to get. I mean, Jakub Voracek smashed his
Ferrari. I saw that.
Ferrari up. Yeah. It was crazy. So somehow his car came up in discussion. He actually posted a picture on Instagram that Dave posted on illegalcurve.com.
He was sending the car to his dad, is that right?
Sending it to his dad in Russia.
So, first of all, does this qualify as a gate, and can we put an end to car gate?
Oh, my God. It was never a gate. It was nothing.
Did he drive it over the ocean, or did he fly it?
Probably drove it.
Yeah. It's a hover car. I'll tell you what. If it was a hover car, then it's a gate.
I think it was like Jesus. He just drove it over water.
How long would that drive take?
I think you could go pretty quick. There's no speed limit on the ocean.
Nice. It's like driving through I think it's Montana or something doesn't have a speed limit either. So, you know, it's just the same thing at that point. Anyways, Alex Burmistrov, he's a restricted free agent.
But
he's got no arbitration eligibility.
That's right.
Which means he's in the same situation that Zach Bogosian was in a couple of years ago with the Winnipeg Jets. 2 years ago, as a matter of fact.
Evander Kane, too.
Evander Kane last year as well. The only difference being, of course, that Evander Kane has produced significant NHL numbers, while Alex Burmistrov has got great Corsi numbers, but, you know, I think I have great Corsi numbers also. You know, so how do you see this situation resolving itself? Ezzy, I'll talk to you first on this one. Alex Burmistrov, is he a Winnipeg Jet come training camp? Is he in the NHL with a different team? Is he playing over in Russia? How do you see this happening?
Yeah, it's a good question. It doesn't look like he'll be playing with the Winnipeg Jets because the Jets tried to trade him at the trade deadline last year, and he was a healthy scratch for 4 games, and in his return didn't do much. So I'd have to go with... there's a good chance that Alexander Burmistrov won't be a Winnipeg Jet next year. And I was disappointed in the way he played. I think he gave up on his team a little bit. I was a big fan of Alexander Burmistrov and the way he played earlier in the season, and I think he trailed off.
Drew, in terms of Burmistrov, you don't want to write off the guy's career because he's got skill and he's good defensively, and he can, to me, play a third-line center role, if focused right now, probably. On a night-to-night basis. I think with Burmistrov here, Chevy's got the hammer. And you know who else had the hammer? Was Mark Bergevin with Subban. And you say to him,
Montreal's general manager.
Yeah, this is what you're getting. You're getting a one-year deal for, let's say, $1 million or one, what, two, whatever it is. And that's what we're offering. Take it or leave it. The problem there is his leverage is not an arbitration or even an offer sheet. I mean, I don't know what offer sheet's that reasonable in the situation. I think more likely is the KHL being tempting for him. And then him saying, I don't care if you have leverage. I'm going to go there and make more money likely and say, you know what, I'm done with you right now. So that's got to be a concern.
Jets don't seem to be like a team that can be in the position to lose any players that can be considered assets.
But you also can't let the inmates run the asylum.
Oh, agreed. I don't think that he can, I don't think he deserves or can, you know, get his way out of town unless the Jets want to accommodate that. Now, you know, you read, you know, Gary's article, Gary Lawless's article about this in the Free Press, and I have to believe that the players that were mentioned in that article are players the Jets asked for and were denied. Because if Garth Snow called up Kevin Cheveldayoff and said, we'll give you Kyle Okposo for Alex Burmistrov, and Cheveldayoff said anything other than yes and yes immediately, I can't wrap my brain around
that.
Well,
he'd have hit Ezzy's beer stash.
If he had said no?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're not going to get... It would be Burmistrov in a package for a guy like Okposo. It'd be the same thing for Stafford. It'd be him in something. Silverberg as well, really. Maybe the one would be a little bit less, but people have high hopes for him in Ottawa. Burmistrov certainly would, to me, have a market, though. If you're really looking to trade him, there will be teams that would be interested in Burmistrov. Guys, he played 3 years in the National Hockey League. He was rushed to the league. But
yeah, he's still got a good...
Somebody can mold him into a really productive center who can play both ways on the ice and hopefully get rid of a lot of the kinks in his game.
Especially because he's got the defensive side of the game.
Yeah,
he's solid defensively.
Yeah, now will he work at his weaknesses? And that's the question. I mean, what has Alexander Burmistrov gotten better at over the course of the past 2 years he's been in Winnipeg? You could point out very little. That's his problem. You come in with the same weaknesses and you leave the same weaknesses, and what are you improving in your game? So those are questions and motivation, but at the same time, you're talking about a guy who's under 22 years old.
Can the situation and the obviously it seems to be some personal differences between him and Coach Noel. Can those be resolved?
Yeah, they can be resolved, I think. I mean, again, that's not insider knowledge by any means, but come on. You're dealing with a young guy, maybe a bit of a chip on his shoulder. You're dealing with a coach who's trying to get that, you know, get the ear of the room. But it's also going to be a leadership issue inside. I mean, we don't know. We're not privy to this information, but what does Andrew Ladd think about this? What do the other players in the dressing room think about this? Do they think he's a guy who's something they would build around? We don't know. Maybe if he isn't, they get rid of him. But it's an unfortunate kind of tale of how this has gone, because the Jets aren't in the position of wasting assets. And to boil it down to that is really what this may end up being, is wasted an asset. It's especially wasted an asset if he goes to the KHL for nothing.
This is a top 10 pick 3 years ago in the NHL. I mean, and there's a lot of top 10 picks in the NHL that take 2 or 3 years just to develop to get there. He's got, you know, that many years under his belt at this point, and that much experience under his belt, that, like you said, to lose him to the KHL for nothing would be a big blow.
To any team, but especially a team that is not exactly loaded with prospects.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when Nashville lost Radulov.
Mm-hmm. Radulov's a better player,
but you know, you lose a guy that you developed and you drafted, and you think he's going to be, you know, you think you're going to be able to control him for at least for 7 years, maybe a decade. Mm-hmm. You know, you think he's going to be a long-term asset on your team, and you lose him for nothing.
I think if you take Alexander Burmistrov off the Jets this year, there's very little negative impact, though, and I think that's why I wouldn't be that much in disagreement with moving him. Meaning that if they don't have Burmistrov on the team this year, I really don't think they miss him that much.
Well, and they may not, Izzy. I mean, the guy's not great on the draw, and you know, he does a lot with the puck, but a lot of nothing a lot of the time. But at the same time, he's a player who shouldn't be commanding that much money, who can fill a role for you, who can play in different situations for you, and has skill and ability. And, I mean, if you trade him for, say, like a second-round pick, and that's the currency for him, will that second-round pick even ever be Alexander Burmistrov?
Well,
the question that needs to be asked.
Never, I mean...
He's not killing you on his cap. I mean, depending on, obviously, a contract, he's not killing you on the cap. How much money can the guy demand?
Well, okay, so let's talk about that. You know, I know, and this, you know...
I'd have to give it a closer look.
I know you'd have to give it a closer look, but, I mean, you know, he's making, you know, he's on an entry-level deal.
He's got no leverage at all.
He's got no leverage. Do you give him...
The only year in the NHL player's career where he has absolutely no leverage, and the Jets have to take advantage of that.
So do you give him, you know, do you start negotiating? Do you give him more than you know...
You don't give him more than 1 year right now.
You don't just go on a one-year deal and see if they can turn things around.
And then he'll know he has arbitration rights the next year, and he can play well, he can drive up that salary next year if they don't want to give him the money. Absolutely. So they have that possibility.
And it's a good problem to have if he outperforms his contract for this 1 year. Right. I mean, a lot of talk about who his agent is.
Yeah, Mark Gandler is you know, I mean, he in good faith represented Alexei Yashin, who, of course, didn't play that year when he had a contract. So his reputation precedes him in that regard.
When you said good faith there, your tongue was firmly in cheek?
It was. Yeah, it was my cheek and then a timbit over here.
Okay. But, yeah, it's, I mean, I think, is that a factor at all? Mark Gandler being his agent? You know, his...
For sure.
You know, he had a player who had a valid contract sit out for an entire year. You know, a little bit shady there. I would use that word.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
And I think that does play a factor. The KHL ties, Mark Gandler and his history wouldn't exactly make me at ease if I was Kevin Cheveldayoff and the Winnipeg Jets brass. There's been a few busts in this organization's history. Patrick Steffen, you know, they traded other ones. It's not exactly been the...
Home run after home run.
So.
Well, that'll be an interesting negotiation to see play out, you know, at least over the next couple months, see how that situation resolves itself, be it in Winnipeg with a trade or maybe somewhere over in Russia.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard, I'll start with you. Cheers or jeers?
Cheer to Theo Fleury.
Yes.
As part of this walk, he called it a life-changing trek, a walk from Toronto to Ottawa to raise awareness and support for tougher laws about child sex abuse. Obviously, it's an emotional topic for him, for many people, and he's doing his best to raise awareness and give him absolute credit and a cheer for putting his time and efforts behind a good cause.
Ezzy, cheer or jeer?
Cheer Hockey Canada for raising the limit in which body checking is allowed. I think the game's evolved, and it's a good decision.
I'll wrap up cheers and jeers by giving a cheer to Phil Housley. He's done really good work with the World Junior program in the United States. He was an assistant coach for the bronze medal winning U.S. team at the World Hockey Championships, and he has been hired as an assistant coach with the Nashville Predators this year for his first NHL job. So a cheer to former Winnipeg Jet Phil Housley on getting that job with the Nashville Predators.
Yeah, welcome through.
Yeah. That's it for this Saturday and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to our guests, Mike Heike from the Dallas Morning News and Sunaya Sapurji, junior hockey columnist with Yahoo Canada. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes. You can search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. It's also available on the tsn1290.ca website. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website featuring the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is www.illegalcurve.com. For producer Michael Remus on loan to us from Rick Ralph and the Rona Roundtable, for my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Join us again for serious hockey talk. Saturdays from noon to 3. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Only on TSN 1290. Your official home of the Winnipeg Jets.